but let's order a drink and discuss that idea.
She took the pages from his hand. Give me my father's name right now or I file this story, she pointed at the bar, from that phone. He slumped in the chair, considered the ceiling fan that rotated slowly above him with a rusty squeak.
She called him JJ.
Rachel placed the article back in her bag to hide the tremors that ran from her hands to her elbows. Why JJ? He turned his hands up on the table, a beleaguered supplicant to fate.
What will I do now? How will I live?
Why did she call him JJ? Her teeth, she realized, were gritted.
You're all the same, he whispered. You bleed men dry. Good men. You're a pestilence.
She stood.
Sit.
He said it loud enough that two diners looked their way.
Please, no, no, just sit. I'll be good. I'll be a good boy.
She sat. Dr. Felix Browner removed a single piece of paper from his suit jacket. It was old and folded in four. He opened it and handed it across the table to her. Her hand shook even worse as she took it, but she didn't care. At the top of the page was the name of his clinic, Browner Women's Health Clinic. Below that, Father's Medical History.
He only came to my office twice. I got the impression they fought a lot. Pregnancies scare some men, settle around them like a noose.
Under last name, in neat block letters and blue ink, he'd printed James. That's why they'd never found him. James was his surname. His first name was Jeremy. Chapter 4. Type B. Jeremy James had been teaching full-time at Connecticut College, a small liberal arts institution in New London, Connecticut, since September 1982. That same year, he bought a house in Durham, a town of 7,000, 60 miles straight down I-91 from where Rachel grew up in South Hadley, and about a 10-minute drive from the house her mother had rented in Middletown the year Rachel came down with mono. He married Maureen Weiderman in July 1983. Their first child, Theo, was born in September 1984. Their second, Charlotte, a Christmas baby, arrived at the end of 1986. I have half-siblings, Rachel thought, blood relations. And she felt, for the first time since her mother had died, as if she were tethered somewhere in the universe. With his full name in her possession, Rachel had Jeremy James's entire life laid out before her in under an hour, or at least the portion that was a matter of public record. He became an associate professor of art history in 1990 and a full professor with tenure in 1995. By the time Rachel tracked him down in the fall of 2007, he'd been teaching at Connecticut College for a quarter century and now chaired the department. His wife, Maureen Weiderman James, was the curator of European art at the Wadsworth Athenaeum in Hartford. Rachel found several pictures of her online and liked her eyes enough to decide she was the way in. She'd looked up Jeremy James online and found his pictures as well. He was bald now and heavily bearded, and in all the photos he looked erudite and imposing. When she introduced herself over the phone to Maureen Weiderman James, there was only the slightest of pauses before Maureen said, "For 25 years I've been wondering when you'd call. I can't tell you what a relief it is to finally hear your voice, Rachel." When Rachel hung up, she stared out the window and tried not to cry. She bit her lip so hard it bled. She drove out to Durham on a Saturday in early October. For most of its history, Durham had been a farming community, and the thin country roads she drove along were pocked by great old trees, faded red barns, and the occasional goat. The air smelled of wood smoke and a nearby apple orchard. Maureen Weiderman James answered the door to the modest house on Gorham Lane. She was a handsome woman with large round glasses that accentuated the calm but penetrating air of curiosity in her light brown eyes. Her chestnut hair was red at the roots and gray along the strands closest to her temples and forehead, and she had it in a messy ponytail. She wore a red and black work shirt, untucked over black leggings and no shoes, and when she smiled, the smile took over her face in a flood of light.
"Rachel,"
she said, with the same mixture of relief and familiarity she'd used on the phone. It cemented the unsettling realization that she'd said Rachel's name more than a few times over the decades.
"Come in."
She stepped aside, and Rachel entered a home that looked like the home of two academics, bookcases in the foyer, consuming the walls in the living room, under a window in the kitchen. Walls painted in vibrant colors, the paint chipped in places and never touched up. Figurines and masks from third world countries in various states of display. Haitian art on the walls. Rachel had been in scores of homes like this during her mother's career. She knew what LPs would be on the built-in shelf in the living room, what magazines would dominate the basket in the bathroom, that the radio in the kitchen was tuned to NPR. She immediately felt at home here. Maureen led her to a pair of pocket doors in the back of the house. She put her hands to the seam between them and looked over her shoulder. "Are you ready?"
"Who could be ready for this?" Rachel admitted with a desperate chuckle. "You'll be fine," Maureen said warmly,
but Rachel caught a sadness in her eyes as well. As much as they may have come to the beginning of one thing, they'd also reached the end of something else. Rachel wasn't sure if that's where the sadness stemmed from, but she suspected it. Nothing would ever be the same in any of their lives. He stood in the center of the room and turned as the doors opened. He was dressed not dissimilarly to his wife, though instead of leggings, he wore gray jeans. His work shirt was also plaid and untucked, but his was blue and black, and worn unbuttoned over a white t-shirt. A few bohemian touches to him, a small silver loop in his left earlobe, three dark rope bracelets around his left wrist, a chunky watch with a fat black leather band on the other wrist. His bald head gleamed. His beard was trimmer than it was in the pictures she'd found online, and he looked older, his eyes sunk a little farther back in their sockets, his face hanging a little lower. He was taller than she'd expected, but his shoulders were stooped at the points. He smiled as she reached him, and it was the smile she remembered, the thing about him she'd remember not only to her grave, but long after she was buried in it. That sudden, uncertain smile of a man who had, at some point in his life, been conditioned to ask for permission before he expressed joy. He took her hands, his gaze searching her, drinking her, darting all over.
"God," he said, "look at you. Just look at you," he whispered.
He pulled her to him with fumbling ferocity. Rachel returned the hug in kind. He was a heavy man now, around the middle and in the arms and back, but she hugged him so tight she could feel her bones make contact with his. She closed her eyes and heard the beat of his heart like a wave in the dark. "He still smells like coffee," she thought. No longer of corduroy, but coffee still. Coffee still.
"Daddy," she whispered.
And he pushed her, ever so gently, away from his chest.
"Sit."
He waved Rachel vaguely toward a couch. She shook her head, steeling herself for the latest shit sandwich.
"I'll stand."
"Then we'll drink."
He went to a bar cart and started fixing all three of them drinks.
"She died when we were overseas, your mother. I did a sabbatical in France that year and didn't learn of her death for years. It wasn't as if we had any shared friends to tell me of her passing. I'm truly sorry for your loss."
He looked directly at her, and the depth of his compassion hit her like a fist. For some reason, the only thing she could think to ask was, "How did you meet?" He'd met her mother, he explained, on the train back from Baltimore, where he'd gone for his own mother's funeral in the spring of 79. Elizabeth was heading east with her Ph.D. from Johns Hopkins to her first teaching post at Mount Holyoke. Jeremy was in his third year as a part-time assistant professor at Buckley College, 15 miles north. They were dating within a week, living together within a month. He brought Rachel and Maureen a scotch and raised his own. They drank.
It was your mother's first year on the job in an extremely liberal region of a liberal state at the end of a liberal decade, so cohabitation without marriage was acceptable. Pregnancy without marriage might have even been more so. Some looked on it as admirable, spitting in the face of the dominant paradigm and all that. However, if she'd simply been knocked up by a person unknown, that would have made her seem tawdry and pathetic, a foolish victim unable to rise above her class. At least, that's what she feared.
Rachel noticed Maureen watching her carefully, half her scotch already gone. Jeremy started rushing through his sentences, his words spilling and stumbling.
But it was one thing to sell the idea to the general populace, the people she worked with, etc. It was quite another thing to try to sell it at home. I mean, I'm not a math professor, but I can still do math, and your mother's was off by 2 months.
Here it is. He just said it, Rachel thought, and took a big pull on her scotch. But I'm not hearing it somehow. I know what he's saying, but I don't. I can't. I just can't.
I would have been willing, even happy, to be part of selling the fiction, but I wasn't willing to keep up the lie in our kitchen, in our bedroom, in the day-to-day of our lives. It was insidious.
Rachel could feel her lips moving ever so slightly, but no words left her mouth. The air in the room was thin, the walls contracted.
I took a blood test,
Jeremy said. A blood test, Rachel repeated slowly. He nodded.
The most basic kind. It would never conclusively prove paternity, but it would conclusively disprove it. You're type B, yes?
A numbness spread through her like she'd mainlined Novocaine into her spinal cavity. She nodded.
Elizabeth's was A.
He drained his scotch, put the glass down on the edge of the desk.
Mine is also A.
Maureen placed a chair behind Rachel. Rachel sat in it. Jeremy was still talking.
You understand, if your mother was A and I'm A but you're B, then—
Rachel waved at the room. Then there's no way you can be my father. She finished her scotch. I understand. For the first time she noticed the pictures on his desk and scattered on the bookshelves and side tables in the office, all of the same two people, his and Maureen's children— Theo and Charlotte through the years, as toddlers at the beach, birthday parties, graduations. Landmark moments and others that could have been forgotten were it not for the camera. But full lives lived, from birth to college. For the past 72 hours, give or take, she'd thought they were her half-siblings. Now they were just someone's kids. And she was back to being an only child. She caught Maureen's eye and shot her a broken smile. I guess this isn't something you could have told me over the phone, huh? No, I get it. I do. She stood, and Maureen came out of her own chair, and Jeremy took two quick steps toward her. She realized they thought she might faint. I'm okay. She found herself looking at the ceiling, noting that it was copper of all things. I'm just really... She searched for the right word. Sad? She answered her own question with a nod. That's it. Sad. Tired, too, you know? Been a long hunt. I'm going to go.
No, Jeremy said. No.
Please, Maureen said. Don't go. We made up the guest room. Be our guest tonight. Take a nap. Stay. Rachel, please. She slept. She never would have thought it possible with all the shame. Shame in knowing how much they pitied her, that they'd avoided this conversation for as long as they had because they hadn't wanted to reduce her to what she was now, an orphan. She could hear a distant tractor as she closed her eyes, and the sound chugged through dreams she couldn't remember. When she opened her eyes 90 minutes later, she felt, if anything, even more exhausted. She went to the window and parted the heavy curtains and looked out on the James's backyard and the backyard that abutted it, that one strewn with children's toys, a short slide of hard plastic, a pink and black buggy. Beyond the yard sat a small cape with a pale slate roof, and beyond that, farmland, The tractor, she'd heard, sat idle in a field. She'd thought she'd known what it was to feel alone, but she hadn't. She'd had an illusion to keep her company, a belief in a false god, a mythical father. When she saw him again, she'd been telling herself in one way or another since she was 3 years old, she'd feel whole, if nothing else. But now she had seen him again, and he was no more connected to her than the tractor. She came down the stairs, and they were waiting for her in the small parlor at the bottom. Rachel stopped in the doorway and noted the pity in their eyes again. She felt like an emotional beggar, going from door to door her whole life, asking perfect strangers to feed her, fill her again. "I'm a bottomless vessel. Fill me up." She met Jeremy's gaze, and it occurred to her that maybe it wasn't pity she saw there, but his own shame. "I get that we weren't blood," she said. "Rachel," Maureen said, "come in." "But that made it okay for you to leave me?"
"I didn't want to leave you."
He held out his hands.
"Not you. Not my Rachel."
She entered the room. She stood behind the chair they'd placed across the sofa where they both sat. He lowered his hands.
"But once she'd decided I was the enemy, and she decided that the first day I showed any doubt about going along with her fantasy of who impregnated her, there was no quarter."
She took the seat.
"You know your mother better than anyone, Rachel, so I'm sure you were well acquainted with her rage. Once it found a target to focus on or a cause in which to channel itself, there was no stopping it, certainly no speaking truth to it. And once I got a blood test, I transformed from an enemy to a cancer in the body of that house, and she went after me with single-minded..."
He searched for the word.
"Madness. She was either going to bring me fully to heel, or she was going to expel me."
"Expunge you." He blinked.
"What did you say?"
"She screamed it at you that last night. I will expunge you." Jeremy and Maureen exchanged startled looks.
"You remember that?"
Rachel nodded. She poured herself a glass of water from the pitcher on the coffee table between them. "And that's what she did. If she'd expelled you, Jeremy, that would have worked out okay for both of us, I think. But when she expunged you, you were erased. The dead have names and grave markers. The expunged never existed." She sipped her water and looked around the parlor at its books and pictures and the record player and LPs just where she'd predicted they would be. She noted the hand-knitted throws and the place where the love seat buckled on the ridgeline and the various scrapes in the hardwood floor and the scuff marks and the wainscoting and the slightly cluttered nature of it all. She thought how nice it must have been to grow up here, to have been the children of Jeremy and Maureen. She lowered her head and closed her eyes, and in the darkness she saw her mother and the playground with the low clouds and the wet swings where Jeremy had taken her as a small child. She saw the house on Westbrook Road, with its piles of sodden leaves the morning after he'd left. Then she saw an alt life, in which he hadn't left, and Jeremy James was her father in all but blood, and he raised her and counseled her and coached her middle school soccer team. And in that alt-life, her mother wasn't a woman consumed by a thirst to bend all the people in her life to fit her own fucked-up narrative of that life, but was instead the person she was in her writing and her teaching, objective, rational, self-deprecating, capable of a love that was simple and direct and mature. But that's not what she and Jeremy got. They got a conflicted, aggressive, toxic mess of outsize intelligence, outsize anxiety, and outsize rage, and all of it bound up in an outwardly competent, cool, and calm Nordic exterior. "I will expunge you." "You expunged him, Mother, and in the process you expunged me and yourself out of the family we could have been, we so easily and joyfully could have been. If you'd just gotten out of your own fucking way, you horrible demon bitch." She raised her head and pushed the hair out of her eyes. Maureen was there with a box of tissues, as Rachel had somehow known she would be. What was that kind of attentiveness called? Oh, right. Mothering. So that's what it looked like. Jeremy had moved to the floor in front of her, sat looking up with his hands clasped around his knees and his face lit with kindness and regret.
Maureen, he said, could I speak to Rachel alone for a minute?
Of course, of course.
Maureen returned the box of tissues to a credenza, then changed her mind, brought it back, and placed it on the coffee table. She refilled Rachel's glass of water. She fussed with the corner of a throw rug. Then she gave them both a smile that was supposed to be comforting but curdled into something terrified. She left the room.
When you were two, Jeremy said, your mother and I fought pretty much every minute we were in each other's presence. Do you know what it's like to fight with someone every day? Someone who claims to dislike conflict, but who in fact lives for it?
Rachel cocked her head at him. You're really asking me this? He smiled, and then the smile went away.
It scours the soul, damages the heart. You can feel yourself dying. Living with your mother, from the time she'd decided I was the enemy onward anyway, was to live in a state of perpetual war. I was walking up the driveway after work once, and I threw up, just puked into the snow covering our lawn. And there was nothing specifically wrong at that particular moment, but I knew that the second I walked into the house, she'd come at me about something. Could be anything, my tone of voice, the tie I chose that day, something I'd said 3 weeks earlier, something someone else had said about me, a feeling she had, an intuition she'd received, as if by divine providence that something was not right about me, a dream that suggested the same.
He shook his head and let out a small gasp, as if surprised how fresh the memories could be even now, almost 30 years later. So why did you hang in there as long as you did? He knelt before her. He took her hands and pressed them to his upper lip and breathed in the smell of them.
You,
he said.
I would have stayed because of you and puked in the driveway every night and gotten an ulcer and early heart disease and every other possible malady if it meant I could have raised you.
He let go of her hands and sat on the coffee table in front of her. But, she managed.
But, he said, your mother knew that. She knew I had no legal footing, but she knew I'd stay in your life whether she liked it or not. So one night, the last night we ever made love, I remember that well, I woke up and she was gone. I ran to your room and you were there, sleeping away. I walked around the house. There was no note, no Elizabeth. No cell phones back then, and we hadn't made any friends I could call.
You'd been there 2 years by that point. You had no friends? He nodded.
2 and a half.
He leaned forward on the edge of the coffee table.
Your mother torpedoed any attempts at a social life. I couldn't see it at the time. We were so overwhelmed with work and having a baby and then a newborn and all the labor-intensive stages of, well, having a child. So I'm not even sure I noticed how cut off we were until that night. I taught in Worcester back then, at Holy Cross. My commute was a bear, and your mother sure wasn't going to socialize in Worcester. But then I'd suggest going out with her co-workers, fellow faculty and such. She'd say, so-and-so secretly hates women, or so-and-so is just so pretentious, or the nuclear option, so-and-so looks at Rachel funny.
Me? He nodded.
How was I going to respond to that?
She used to do the same thing with my friends, Rachel said. All these backhanded slights, you know? Jennifer seems nice, for someone with her insecurities. Or, Chloe could be so pretty, but why does she dress that way? Does she know the message she's sending? Rachel rolled her eyes at it now, but she could feel the stab of it just below her ribcage to realize how many friendships her mother had shamed her out of. Jeremy said,
sometimes she'd actually make plans with another couple or a group of co-workers and we'd be all set to go. And then, right at the last minute, it would fall through. The sitter's car broke down.
Elizabeth felt ill. You looked like you were coming down with something. Doesn't she feel hot, JJ? The other couple called to cancel, even though I couldn't recall hearing the phone ring. The excuses always seemed perfectly reasonable in the moment. It was only over time, in the rear view, that I saw how they piled up. Either way, we had no friends.
So this night she disappeared.
She came back at dawn, he said. She'd been beaten.
He looked at the floor.
And worse. All the visible injuries were to her body, not her face, but she'd been raped and battered.
By who? He met her eyes.
There's the question. She'd been to the police, though, had pictures taken. She consented to a rape kit.
He sucked a wet breath to the back of his throat.
She told the police she wouldn't identify her attacker. Not then, anyway. But once she came home and told me, she assured me that if I didn't come to my senses and admit the truth, she...
Wait a minute, Rachel said. What truth?
That I'd impregnated her.
But you hadn't.
Right. So she insisted I say I had. She said the only way we could be together was if I was wholly honest with her and stopped lying about fathering you. I said, Elizabeth, I'll tell the world I'm Rachel's father. I'll sign all documents to that effect. If we divorce, I'll pay child support until she's 18. But what I won't do, what I can't do, what is categorically insane to ask me to do is to claim to you, her mother, that I planted the seed. That's too much to ask of anyone.
And what did she say to that? Rachel asked, even though she had a pretty good idea.
She asked me why I insisted on lying. She asked me what sickness was in me that I would try to make her seem as if she were being unreasonable about something so crucial. She asked me to admit that I was trying to make her look as if she were insane.
He pressed his palms together, as if in prayer, and his voice grew very soft, almost a whisper.
The game, as I understood it, was that she could never believe I loved her unless I agreed to abide by an unreasonable contract. The unreasonable aspect of the demand was the point. That was her deal-breaker. Meet me there in the cave of my own insanity, or meet me nowhere.
And you chose nowhere.
I chose the truth.
He leaned back on the table.
And my sanity.
Rachel felt a bitter smile tug the corners of her mouth. She didn't like that, did she?
She told me if I was determined to live a life of cowardice and lies, then I could never see you again. If I left that house, I was leaving your life forever.
And you left.
And I left.
And never attempted contact. He shook his head.
That was her checkmate in the end.
He leaned forward, placed his palms softly on her kneecaps.
If I ever tried to make contact, your mother told me, she'd tell the police that I was the man who'd raped her.
Rachel tried to get her head around it. Would her mother have gone to those lengths to drive Jeremy James, or anyone for that matter, from her life? That would be beyond the pale, even for Elizabeth, wouldn't it? But then Rachel recalled the fates of others who'd run afoul of Elizabeth Childs during her childhood. There'd been a dean whom Elizabeth had ever so gradually poisoned the faculty against, a fellow psych professor whose contract was not renewed, a janitor who was fired, an employee at the town bakery who was let go. All these people and a couple more had crossed Elizabeth Childs, or if she believed they had, and her retaliation was heartless and calculated. Her mother, she knew all too well, had thought at all times in tactical terms. "Do you think she was raped?" she asked Jeremy. He shook his head.
"I think she had sex with me, and then she either paid or coerced someone into beating her up. I've had years to think about it, and that's the scenario I find likeliest."
"Because you wouldn't live a lie within your own home?" He nodded.
"And because I'd seen the depths of her own insanity, and that she could never forgive."
Rachel kept twirling it in her head, over and over. Eventually, she admitted to the man who should have been her father, "When I think of her, and I think of her too much, I sometimes wonder if she was evil." Jeremy shook his head.
"No, she wasn't. She was just the most profoundly damaged human being I've ever met. And she was relentlessly hostile, if crossed, I'll give you that. But there was great love in her heart."
Rachel laughed.
"For who?"
He gave her a look of dark befuddlement.
"For you, Rachel. For you."
Chapter 5. On Luminism. After she met the man she'd mistakenly believed to be her father, a surprising thing happened. She and Jeremy James became friends. There wasn't much tentative about it. They dove in, more like long-lost siblings than a 63-year-old man and a 28-year-old woman who turned out not to be related. When Elizabeth Childs died, Jeremy and his family had been in Normandy, where Jeremy had used his sabbatical to research a subject that had long fascinated him, the possible link between Luminism and Expressionism. Now, as his academic career was winding down and retirement loomed, Jeremy was trying to write his book on Luminism, an American style of landscape painting often confused with Impressionism. As Jeremy explained it to Rachel, who knew less than zero about art, Luminism grew out of the Hudson River School. It was Jeremy's belief that the two schools shared a link, even if prevailing theory, dogma, actually, Jeremy would scoff, held that the two schools had developed independently of each other in the late 1800s on opposite sides of the Atlantic. A man named Colum Jasper Whitstone, Jeremy told her, had worked as an apprentice to two of the most famous Luminists, George Caleb Bingham and Albert Bierstadt, but vanished in 1863 along with a large sum of money from the Western Union office where he was employed. Neither the money nor Colum Jasper Whitstone was ever heard of again in the Americas, but the diary of Madame de Fontaine, a wealthy widow and arts patron in Normandy, twice made mention of a Callum Whitestone in the summer of 1865, referring to him as a gentleman from America with good manners, refined tastes, and a cloudy heritage. When Jeremy first told Rachel this, his eyes were lit like a birthday child's, and his baritone voice grew several octaves lighter.
"Monet and Boudin painted the Normandy coast the same year. They would set up every day just down the street from Madame de Fontaine's summer cottage."
Jeremy believed these two giants of Impressionism had crossed paths with Colum Jasper Whitstone, that Whitstone was, in fact, the missing link between American Luminism and French Impressionism. All he had to do was prove it. Rachel pitched in with research, aware of the irony that she and her not-father were searching for a man who'd vanished into the dust and void of 150 years, when together they couldn't identify the man who'd fathered Rachel a little over 30 years before. Jeremy often visited her apartment during research trips to the MFA, the Boston Athenaeum, and the Boston Public Library. She'd departed the Globe for TV by then and had moved in with Sebastian, a producer at Channel 6. Sometimes Sebastian was there and would join them for dinner or drinks, but mostly he was working or on his boat.
"You're such an attractive couple," Jeremy said one night at her apartment.
And the word attractive left his mouth sounding unattractive. He had developed an ability to say all the right things about Sebastian, taking note of his intelligence, his dry wit, his good looks, his air of competency, without sounding like he meant any of them. He examined a picture of the two of them on Sebastian's beloved boat. He placed it back on the mantle and gave Rachel a pleasant, distracted smile, as if he were trying to come up with one more positive thing to say about the two of them, but had drawn a blank.
"He sure works a lot."
"He does," she agreed.
"He wants to run the whole station one day, I bet."
"He wants to run the network," she said. He chuckled and carried his glass of wine to the bookshelves, where he zeroed in on a photograph of Rachel and her mother that Rachel had almost forgotten was there. Sebastian, not a fan of the photo or its frame, had crammed it at the end of a row of books, backed into a shadow cast by a copy of History of America in 101 Objects. Jeremy removed it gently and tilted the book so it remained standing. She watched his face turn both dreamy and desolate.
"How old were you in this?"
7, she said.
"Hence the missing teeth."
"Mm-hmm. Sebastian thinks I look like a hobbit in that picture."
"He said that?"
"He was joking."
"That's what we're calling it?"
He carried the photograph back to the couch and sat beside her. 7-year-old Rachel, missing both upper front teeth and one lower, had stopped smiling for cameras at the time. Her mother wouldn't hear of it. Elizabeth found a set of rubber fangs somewhere and used a Sharpie to black out one of the upper teeth and 2 of the lower. She'd had Anne-Marie take a series of pictures of her and Rachel vamping for the camera one drizzly afternoon at the house in South Hadley. In this, the only photograph to survive from that day, Rachel was wrapped in her mother's arms, both of them beaming their hideous smiles as broadly as possible.
"I'd forgotten just how pretty she was, too. My goodness."
Jeremy gave Rachel an ironic smile.
"She looks like your boyfriend."
"Shut up," Rachel said. But it was, unfortunately, true. How had she never noticed before? Both Sebastian and her mother looked like Aryan ideals, hair several shades whiter than vanilla, cheekbones as sharp as their jawlines, arctic eyes, and lips so small and thin they couldn't help but appear secretive.
"I know men marry their mothers," Jeremy said. "But this is..."
She nudged an elbow into his paunch. "Enough." He laughed and kissed her head and put the photograph back where it belonged.
"Do you have more?"
"Pictures?" He nodded.
"I never got to see you grow up."
She found the shoebox of them in her closet. She dumped them out onto the small kitchen table so that her life took the shape of a messy collage, which seemed all too fitting. Her 5th birthday party, a day at the beach when she was a teenager, semi-formal during junior year of high school, in her soccer uniform sometime during middle school, hanging in the basement with Caroline Ford, which would have been when she was 11, because Caroline Ford's father had been visiting faculty for that 1 year only, Elizabeth and Anne-Marie and Dawn Clay at a cocktail party by the looks of it, Rachel and Elizabeth the day Rachel graduated from middle school, Elizabeth, Anne-Marie, Anne-Marie's first husband Richard, and Giles Ellison at the Williamstown Theater Festival, and again at a cookout, everyone's hair a little thinner and a little grayer in the latter. Rachel, the day her braces were removed. 2 of Elizabeth and 6 unidentified friends at a bar. Her mother was quite young, possibly still in her 20s, and Rachel didn't recognize any of the other people or the bar where they were gathered. "Who are those people?" she asked Jeremy. He glanced at it.
"No idea."
"They look like academics." She picked up the photograph and the one below it, which appeared to have been taken within a minute of the first. "She looks so young, I figured it was taken when she first got to the Berkshires." He considered the photo in her right hand, the one in which her mother was caught unaware, her eyes on the bottles behind the bar.
"No, I don't know any of those people. I don't even know that bar. That's not in the Berkshires, at least not any place I've ever been."
He adjusted his glasses and leaned in.
"The Colts."
"Huh?"
"Look."
She followed his finger. In the corner of the frame of both photographs, just past the bar, at the entrance to the kind of paneled hallway that usually leads to restrooms, a pennant hung on the wall. Only 1/2 of it had made it into the frame, the 1/2 with the team logo, a white helmet with a dark blue horseshoe in the center, the Indianapolis Colts logo. "What was she doing in Indianapolis?" Rachel said.
"The Colts didn't move to Indy until 1984. Before that, they were in Baltimore. This would have been taken when she was at Johns Hopkins, before you were born."
She laid the picture, in which her mother wasn't looking at the camera, back down on top of the collage, and they both peered at the one where the principals looked into the lens. "Why are we staring at this?" Rachel eventually asked.
"You ever know your mother to be sentimental or nostalgic?"
"No."
"So why did she keep these 2 pictures?"
"Good point." There were three men and three women, including her mother, in the center of the frame. They'd gathered at one corner of the bar and pulled their stools close together. Big smiles and glassy eyes. The oldest of them was a heavy-set man farthest to the left. He looked to be about 40, with mutton-chop sideburns, a plaid sport coat, bright blue shirt, and wide knit tie loosened below an unbuttoned collar. Beside him was a woman in a purple turtleneck, with her dark hair pulled back in a bun, a nose so small you had to look for it, and barely any chin. Next to her was a thin black woman with a jerry-curl perm. She wore a white blazer with the collar turned up over a black halter top, a long white cigarette held up by her ear, but not yet lit. Her left hand rested on the arm of a trim black man in a tan three-piece suit with thick square glasses and an earnest, forthright gaze. Beside him was a man wearing a white shirt and black tie under a velour zip-front pullover. His brown hair was parted in the middle, blown dry, and feathered along the temples. His green eyes were playful, maybe a bit lascivious. He had his arm around Rachel's mother, but they all had their arms around each other, huddling close together. Elizabeth Child sat on the end. She wore a billowy pinstriped blouse with the top three buttons undone, publicly revealing more cleavage than she ever had in Rachel's lifetime. Her hair, which had always been cut short during her years in the Berkshires, fell almost to her shoulders and was, true to the times, feathered on the sides. But even with the fashion fails common to the era, her mother's sheer force of self pulled one to her. She stared back from a remove of more than three decades, as if she'd known as the picture was being taken that circumstances would one day put her daughter and a man she'd almost married in the exact position where they now found themselves, searching her face yet again for clues to her soul. But in pictures, as in life, those clues were opaque and fruitless. Her smile was both the most brilliant of the six and the only one that didn't quite reach her eyes. She was smiling because it was expected of her, not because she felt it, an impression underscored in the other photo, which looked to have been taken seconds before or seconds after the posed shot. Seconds after, Rachel realized, because the tip of the black woman's cigarette glowed a fresh red in the second photo. Her mother's smile was gone, and she was turning back to the bar, her eyes on the bottles to the right of the cash register. Whiskey bottles, Rachel was mildly surprised to note, not the vodka bottles she would have expected her mother to show an interest in. Her mother was no longer smiling, but she looked happier because of it. Her face bore an intensity that Rachel would have characterized as erotically charged, had its focus been anything but the bottles of whiskey. It appeared as if her mother had been caught in a reverie, in anticipation of an encounter with whomever she was leaving that bar with or meeting up with afterward. Or she was just glancing at whiskey bottles and wondering what she'd have for breakfast tomorrow. Rachel realized, with no small amount of shame, that she was projecting at a nearly unforgivable level because she wanted to find value in photos that had none. This is silly. She went to get the bottle of wine they'd left on the counter.
What about it is silly?
Jeremy placed both photos side by side. I feel like we're looking for him here.
We are looking for him here.
It's two photographs from a night at a bar when she was in grad school. She refilled their glasses and left the bottle on the table between them. Nothing more.
I lived with your mother for 3 years. Except for pictures of you, there were no pictures, not one. I now discover the existence of these two, tucked away somewhere the whole time I lived with her, but never to be shared with me. Why? What's in these pictures on this night that matters? I say it's your father.
Could just be a night she was fond of.
He raised an eyebrow.
Could just be two pictures she forgot she had.
The eyebrow stayed up. Fine, she said. Make your pitch. He pointed at the man closest to her mother, velour man with the feathered brown hair.
He has the same color eyes as you.
Fair enough. Like Rachel, he did have green eyes, though his were a much brighter shade. Hers were so light they were almost gray. And, like Rachel, he did have brown hair. The shape of his head wasn't far off from Rachel's own. The size of the nose was about right. His chin was quite pointed, whereas Rachel's was more squared off. But then her mother's had been squared off, too, so one could argue she'd simply gotten her mother's chin, but her father's eyes and hair. He was a handsome man, porn stash notwithstanding, but there was something lightweight about him, and her mother did not have a known affinity for the lightweight. Jeremy and Giles might not have been the most overtly masculine men Rachel had ever come across, but there was steel at the core of both of them, and their intelligence was prodigious and immediately identifiable. Velour Man, on the other hand, looked like he was on his way to MC a junior Miss pageant. "Does he seem like her type?" Rachel said.
"Did I?"
Jeremy asked. "You have gravitas," Rachel said. "My mother dug gravitas."
"Well, it's not this guy."
Jeremy put his finger on the heavy-set guy with the eyesore of a sport coat.
"And it's not this guy."
He put his finger on the black guy.
"Maybe the cameraman."
"Camera woman." Rachel showed him the reflection in the bar mirror of a woman with a mane of brown hair spilling from underneath a multicolored knit cap, the camera held in two hands.
"Ah."
She looked at the other people who'd been inadvertently captured on film. Two old men and a middle-aged couple sat midway down the bar. The bartender made change at the cash register, and a youngish guy in a black leather jacket was frozen in mid-stride after coming through the front doors. "What about him?" she asked. Jeremy adjusted his glasses and hunched in close to the photo.
"Can't get a good enough look. Wait, wait, wait."
He got up and went to the canvas backpack he took everywhere on his research trips. He removed a magnifying glass paperweight and brought it to the table. He held it over the face of the guy in the leather jacket. The guy had the surprised look of a man who'd almost stepped into a photographer's shot and ruined it. He was also darker-skinned than he'd appeared from a remove. Latin American or Native American, possibly, but not in line with Rachel's own ethnic makeup in either case. Jeremy moved the magnifying glass back over to Velour Man. He definitely had the same color eyes as Rachel. What had her mother said? Look for yourself in his eyes. Rachel stared at Velour Man's magnified eyes until they blurred. She looked away to readjust her vision, and then back again. "Are those my eyes?" she asked Jeremy.
"They're your color," he said. "Different shape, but you got your bone structure from Elizabeth anyway. Do you want me to make a couple calls?"
"To whom?" He placed the paperweight down on the table.
"Let's take another leap, and consider that these were her fellow students in the PhD program at JHU that year. If that presumption is correct, everyone in this picture is probably identifiable. If it's incorrect, I'm only out a few phone calls to friends who work there."
"Okay." He took pictures of both photographs with his phone, checked the images to make sure they were captured correctly, and put the phone in his pocket. At her door, he turned back and said,
"Are you all right?"
"Fine. Why?"
"You seem kinda hollowed out suddenly."
It took her a minute to find the words. "You're not my father."
"No."
"But I wish you were. Then this would be over, and I'd have a cool guy like you for a dad." He adjusted his glasses, something she learned he did whenever he felt uncomfortable.
"I've never in my life been called a cool guy."
"That's why you're cool," she said, and kissed his cheek. She received her first email from Brian Delacroix in 2 years. It was brief, 3 lines, and complimented her on a series of stories she'd done 2 weeks before on allegations of kickbacks and patronage in the Massachusetts probation department. The head of the department, Douglas Dougie O'Halloran, had run the department like his personal fiefdom. But now, based on work done by Rachel and some of her old colleagues at the Globe, the DA was prepping indictments. "When Dougie saw you coming toward him," Brian wrote, "he looked fit to shit a collie." She caught herself beaming. "It's good to know you're out there, Miss Childs." "You too," she considered writing back. But then she saw his P.S. "Crossing back across the southern border, returning to New England. Any hoods you'd recommend?" She immediately Googled him, something she'd consciously refrained from doing until now. There was only one picture of him in Google Images, slightly grainy, which had first appeared in the Toronto Sun coverage of a charity gala in 2000. But there he was, in an incongruous tux, head turned to the side, identified in the caption as Lumber Scion Brian Delacroix III. In the accompanying article, he was described as low-key and notoriously private, a graduate of Brown with an MBA from Wharton, who'd then taken those degrees and become a private investigator in Chicopee, Massachusetts for a year? She smiled to remember him in that shoebox office, a golden boy trying to reject the path his family had laid out for him, but clearly conflicted about this choice he'd made. So earnest, so honest. If she'd walked through any other door, handed any other private investigator her case, he or she would have done exactly what Brian had warned her they would, bled her dry. Brian, on the other hand, had refused to do so. She stared at his photograph and imagined him living a neighborhood or two over, or maybe a block or two over. "I am with Sebastian," she said aloud. "I love Sebastian." She closed her laptop. She told herself she'd respond to Brian's email tomorrow, but she never got around to it. 2 weeks later, Jeremy James called and asked if she was sitting down. She wasn't, but she leaned against a wall and told him she was.
"I've identified pretty much everyone. The black couple are still together and both work in private practice in St. Louis. The other woman died in 1990. The big guy was faculty. He passed too a few years back. And the guy in the velour pullover is Charles Osaris, a clinical psychologist who practices on Oahu."
"Hawaii," she said.
"If he turns out to be your dad," Jeremy said, "you'll have a great place to visit. I'll expect an invitation."
"But of course." It took her 3 days to call Charles Osaris. It wasn't a case of nerves or trepidation of any kind. It was rooted instead in despair. She knew he wasn't her father, knew it in the pit of her stomach and in every electromagnetic strand of her lizard brain. Yet some part of her hoped for the opposite. Charles Osaris confirmed that he had been in the Johns Hopkins PhD program in clinical psychology with Elizabeth Childs. He could recall several nights when they went to a bar called Milo's in East Baltimore, where, indeed, a Baltimore Colts pennant had hung on the wall to the right of the bar. He was sorry to hear Elizabeth had passed away. He'd found her an intriguing woman. "I was told you two dated," Rachel said.
"Who on earth would tell you something like that?"
Charles Osaris let out a sound that was half bark, half laugh.
"I've been out of the closet since the 70s, Miss Childs. I never had any illusions about my sexuality either. Confusion, yes, but illusions, no. Never dated a woman, never even kissed one."
"Clearly I was misinformed," Rachel said.
"Clearly. Why would you ask if I dated your mother?"
Rachel came clean, told him she was looking for her father.
"She never told you who he was?"
"No."
"Why?"
And Rachel responded with the explanation that, with every passing year, seemed more ludicrous. "For some reason, she thought she was protecting me. She confused keeping something secret with keeping me safe."
"The Elizabeth I knew was never confused about anything in her life."
"Why else keep something so big a secret?" Rachel asked. When he responded, his voice was newly tinged with sadness.
"I knew your mother for 2 years. I was the only man within a 10-mile radius who wasn't trying to separate her from her clothing, so I probably knew her as well as anyone. She felt safe with me. And, Miss Childs, I didn't know her at all. She didn't let people in. She liked having a secret life because she liked secrets. Secrets were power. Secrets were better than sex. Secrets, I firmly believe, were your mother's drug of choice."
After her conversation with Charles Osaris, Rachel had 3 panic attacks in 1 week. She had one in the employee bathroom at Channel 6, another on a bench along the Charles River during what was supposed to be her morning jog, and the third in the shower one night after Sebastian fell asleep. She hid them all from Sebastian and her co-workers. As much as one could feel in control during a panic attack, she felt in control of herself. She was able to continually remind herself that she wasn't having a heart attack, that her throat wasn't permanently constricting, that she could, in fact, breathe. Her desire to remain indoors intensified. For a few weeks, only conscious effort and internal howls of defiance pushed her out the door every morning. Weekends, she stayed in completely. For the first 3 weekends, Sebastian assumed it was part of the nesting instinct. By the fourth, he'd grown irritable. Back then, they were on the guest list to just about every party in the city. Any gala, any charity function, any see or be seen excuse to imbibe. They'd become a power couple, fixtures of gossip items in the inside track and names and faces. Rachel, try as she might, couldn't deny how much she enjoyed the position. If she had no parents, she'd realize in retrospect, at least the city welcomed her into the tribal fold. So she got back out there. She shook hands and kissed cheeks and drank in the attention of the mayor, the governor, judges, billionaires, comedians, writers, senators, bankers, Red Sox, Patriots, Bruins, and Celtics players and coaches, and college presidents. At Channel 6, she rocketed through the ranks, racing from freelance to the education beat to crime to general assignment in 16 months flat. They put her face on a billboard with Shelby and Grant, the evening anchors, and prominently featured her in a commercial to introduce their revamped logo. When she and Sebastian decided to marry, it felt like they'd elected themselves homecoming king and queen, and the city applauded the decision and gave its full blessing. It was a week after the invitations went out that she ran into Brian Delacroix. She'd just interviewed 2 reps at the State House over a projected budget shortfall. Her crew went to the van, but she decided to walk back to the station. She'd just crossed the other side of Beacon when Brian walked out of the Athenaeum accompanied by a shorter, older man with ginger hair and a matching beard. She experienced that electric bolt of confusion and recognition that usually only occurred when she passed someone famous in the street. It was a feeling of, I know you, but I really don't. Both men were 10 or 12 feet from Rachel when Brian's eyes found hers. A flash of recognition was followed immediately by a flash of something she couldn't identify. Was it annoyance? Fear? Neither? And then that flash vanished and was replaced with what, in retrospect, she could only describe as manic joy.
Rachel Childs! He crossed the distance to her in one long stride. What's it been, 9 years?
His handshake was firmer than she expected, too firm. 8, she said. When did you—
This is Jack, Brian said.
He stepped aside so the smaller man could step into the space he'd made, and now they were a threesome standing on the sidewalk at the peak of Beacon Hill as lunchtime crowds streamed around them.
Jack Ahern.
The man shook her hand. His handshake was much lighter. There was a strong whiff of old world to Jack Ahern. His shirt had French cuffs with silver cufflinks that peeked out from under the sleeves of his bespoke suit. He wore a bow tie, and his beard was precisely trimmed. His hand was dry and uncalloused. She imagined he owned a pipe and knew more than most about classical music and cognac. He said,
Are you old friends with—
Brian cut in.
Friends would be a bit strong. We knew each other a decade ago, Jack. Rachel's a reporter on Channel 6 here. She's excellent.
Jack gave her a polite nod, approximating respect.
Do you like the work?
Most days, she said. What kind of work are you in?
Jack's in antiquities, Brian said in a rush. He's up here from Manhattan.
Jack Ahern smiled.
By way of Geneva.
I'm not sure what that means, Rachel said.
Well, I live in Manhattan and Geneva, but I consider Geneva home. Isn't that something?
Brian said, even though it wasn't. He glanced at his watch.
Gotta go, Jack. Reservations for 12:15. Rachel, a pleasure.
He leaned in and kissed the air to the side of her cheek.
I heard you're getting married. Very happy for you. Congratulations. Jack Ahern took her hand again with a courtly bow.
I hope you and the groom will be very happy. Take care of yourself, Rachel.
Brian was already moving away with a distant smile and two bright eyes.
Great seeing you.
They walked down to Park Street and took a left and passed.